I think everybody that I talk to agrees that there's a problem with medical training. Medical residents feel overworked, we feel underpaid, we feel that we're not receiving the value for the work that we're putting into the institutions and the huge sacrifices that we make to get to the places that we are. And my worry is that it's keeping people away from medicine and that we're starting to see a shift nationally where our profession is losing ground. And it's starting from the bottom with trainees.
But it feels a lot like when you are coping with teenagers as a parent, and you can't seem to bridge that gap where they understand that you deeply care about them. And this is how you're showing your caring, is making sure that they are prepared, that they have what they need, and that you are entrusting them and empowering them to grow through uncomfortable times and to adapt to what is surely a never-ending list of life's difficulties. I think that's the first core misfire or mistaken assumption underlying almost all of these conversations.
I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. You just heard from Philip Sossenheimer, a palliative care fellow at Stanford, and Amy Holthauser, a professor of pediatrics at the University of Louisville. Sossenheimer led Stanford's trainee unionization efforts, and Holthauser recently stepped down as associate dean for medical education. The contrast in their perspectives is not uncommon. That's why, as I spoke with trainees and medical educators throughout the country, I found myself often thinking about that viral dress meme from 2015. For those who don't live online, the dress became an internet sensation because when some people looked at it, they saw a dress that was blue and black, and when others looked at it, they saw a dress that was white and gold. The dress went viral partly because it was fun, and also because it was shocking that two people could look at the same image and see vastly different things. But for those of us who think about the world in metaphor, and I'm probably one of those people, the dress, as fun as it was, also had a darker meaning, a glimpse of a society where people could look at the same image or set of facts and perceive an entirely different reality. To be clear, when it comes to medical training, I don't think the rifts between trainees and educators are nearly as stark. We all recognize our healthcare system has massive problems. Many, meaning both trainees and practicing clinicians, are disturbed by medicine's corporatization. And I truly believe that most of us are motivated by a desire to help people. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. But when I heard trainees describing the issues they're facing, that time on service no longer feels educational, or that they're not valued, I found myself thinking, they're seeing the world in blue and black, and I'm still seeing it in white and gold. So that's what we're going to talk about this season. What are the real problems in medical training? What factors drive our differing perceptions? And how can we find a way forward that honors trainees' reality and maintains their well-being, but also ensures that future patients will be well cared for? Most of the episodes in this season will focus on one topic in depth, but in this episode, we're going to provide more of a bird's eye view. So first, how did we get here?
Trainees in particular feel like they're really the cogs in a wheel. And I think that the pandemic is the large elephant in the room, and I think it's defined the evolution of a cohort of students and trainees, myself included.
That's Nino Mihatov. Nino's a structural and interventional cardiologist at Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Brooklyn Methodist, where he's also the associate program director for the General Cardiology Fellowship. Nino also did a chief year at Massachusetts General Hospital, which means he was in training for 9 years. At the tail end of his training, COVID happened, which means Nino's also thought a lot about how the pandemic upended medical training.
My interventional fellowship, which was designed to foster the development of procedural skills, was in parts of which were spent in a ICU caring for intubated patients with COVID-19. And I think what particularly is relevant to the pandemic is how training was supplanted or by institutional clinical needs. I was recently talking to one of my colleagues in terms of early career status, and she reminded me of a story and told me a story that she still, I think, describes very bitterly. Is when she was an advanced subspecialty fellow, she depended on supplemental income through moonlighting to afford both childcare and rent in one of the highest cost of living cities in the U.S. And she still harbors some resentment towards her health system when it was decided that traditional moonlighting roles would be sundowned and would become part of a trainee's expected response to the pandemic. Schedules were adjusted rather unilaterally, and that supplemental income was lost despite an increase in childcare burden. It's easy to say that the pandemic required all of us to make sacrifices, but I do have to wonder if there was some way that that experience for her, and I think for many others, particularly during the pandemic, could have played out in a way that didn't just foster an increasing sense of, I think, loss of agency, loss of voice in processes, and I think a sense of less fulfillment in, I think, the joy of medicine.
It's hard to exaggerate how much the pandemic contributed to trainee disillusionment. Nearly every trainee we interviewed, no matter the topic, brought it up. I talked to Deshaun Hickman, a fourth-year emergency medicine resident at Highland Hospital in Oakland, California, about the rise in trainee unionization.
Some of it really does have to do with the pandemic and the strain that it put on the workforce. Residents are already overworked, working, you know, an average of 80-hour weeks, which is already sort of unheard of in other industries. Often our patients and their families, even our own families, don't even realize how much we work and for how little pay we are working. And the COVID pandemic really exacerbated those circumstances. So not only were residents sort of being called in to work shifts because their co-residents were sick, so that means we're working more, but you're in this hazardous situation. We really didn't know anything about COVID at the beginning of the pandemic, so we're like quite literally risking our lives to help our patients. And I think it made us really reflect on our jobs, how the hospitals were treating us.
And the pandemic really revealed this disconnect between the C-suite executives and the trainees. People would see hospital leadership on the news at night, Zooming from their second homes, while the trainees were on the front lines without a voice. This all contributed to a sense that their lives were expendable. Here's Austin Witt, whose family medicine residency spanned the pandemic.
I can remember vividly my first inpatient rotation in the hospital where for the attendings that were in high-risk groups, which largely had to do with age, they were asked not to go into the rooms and for the residents to do the assessments and the physical exams and to relay findings, and they could take the little Bluetooth stethoscope if they were really concerned and needed an attending to like listen to a finding. And it was at that point, like probably weeks after it actually happened, that I was just like, wow, they really just said like, well, you guys can go expose yourself to this danger. And if you guys go out, it's fine. We'll get more residents. But if the attendings go out, then, you know, there's more implications there. And I think that while it was understandable, given the context of the pandemic, it was still kind of one of those things where you're just kind of like, huh, that doesn't feel good as a person to kind of feel like you've been kind of thrown to the wolves.
And again, Philip Sossenheimer.
I remember during the pandemic, many of us getting jeopardized to COVID wards, and that trend continues and predated the pandemic as well. But I think a lot of folks feel like they're basically a warm body with an NPI and that they can be slotted in like any other person can be slotted into this equation to solve the staffing needs of the hospital. We have very little control over our working conditions.
The pandemic was also very socially isolating, which compounded the effects on trainees. Dima El-Choufi, who just finished her family medicine residency at Duke.
It was very, very, very hard. I think one of the hardest pieces was that all of our orientation was done virtually. Our graduation was virtual. Our match day was virtual. I was one of six folks in my cohort intern year, and we did not have a chance to get together really until the vaccine came out. We would see each other, you know, in clinic peripherally or in the hospital setting, and occasionally we would have one-on-one coffees or drinks outside, 6 feet apart, masked, the whole nine. And it was very, very isolating. I remember also just intern year feels like you are, you know, the old saying of drinking from a fire hose, but also just feeling like you were drowning. And I just remember looking out to, you know, texting with my co-residents, and it's almost like you're seeing them in a sea and you're all kind of drowning, but you see them on the horizon. And I remember a time when I drove through downtown Durham and just saw people eating pizza and having fun. And I couldn't believe what we were battling in the hospital and how it also seemed to not be the reality of so many people. And that was very, very hard as well.
El-Choufi also pointed out the distress many of the trainees experienced during the pandemic, as the profound inequities our patients experience were laid bare.
From a system standpoint, I think we all saw the ripple effects of COVID across the entire health system. And I luckily had a lot of exposure to things like social drivers of health and social determinants of health. And they were especially apparent to me in medical school, being in the county hospital and seeing the patients that are largely underinsured or uninsured, and watching how many things get in the way of them being able to take care of themselves, being able to access care, etc. And I remember very distinctly feeling that there's large swaths of the population that we are just really not doing a good job caring for. A lot of it has to do with the way our health system is structured, but I feel that the COVID pandemic just tipped the scales in a way that were really stark.
But though the pandemic had this very direct impact on trainees, now that it's largely receded, we'd expect some of this disillusionment to go away. But I'm not sure it has. And partly that's because the problems COVID exposed in the healthcare system haven't gone away. And partly it may be because the pandemic also had a profound impact on how people in society at large view work and its role in our lives. Deshaun Hickman.
I think that we're also building on just the national labor force that's happening, the momentum that's happening. We're all on social media. We can see what's happening in other industries. It makes sense that people are asking for living wages, that people are asking for time off, that people are asking to be able to have a baby and actually spend time with that baby before I have to come back to work. And I think, you know, seeing that really motivates us to want better for ourselves as well. People usually go into medicine because they're selfless and they want to help patients. And I think for so long, we've allowed the hospital system, the medical care system, if you will, to sort of just take advantage of our goodwill. And I think now we realize, especially with how much money these medical systems are making, and we won't even talk about insurance companies, that there is enough to go around.
Chelsea Harris, a plastic surgery fellow at the University of Maryland, who we'll hear from more later in the season, also echoed this sentiment.
Yeah, and I think it's also really easy as residents. You can slide into the like, and I'm making $50,000 a year. Like you're, you know, these C-suite people who are making millions are doing whatever, and I'm stuck here without a voice in my life.
But it's not only that being a resident doesn't pay all that well. It's that it's extremely hard.
Something I joke with my co-residents and I used to joke about was that sometimes it felt that older generations were like, you guys have it so much better than we used to. We used to have to not sleep for 32 hours, you know, things that were totally outrageous. And I remember thinking, like, I'm really sorry that you got hit by a bus. I'm still getting hit by a sedan, but we're still getting hit by vehicles. Like, why do we keep getting hit by vehicles?
Dima's right. Older generations have basically been doing this, assuming our own generation's superiority, since at least 624 BC. This tendency has a fitting name. It's the kids these days, a fact, and it can make it really difficult to separate real generational change from the tricks of our minds. That's why I spoke to John Protzko, a psychologist and assistant professor at Central Connecticut State, who's actually studied the kids these days effect and tried to identify the psychological mechanism that's led humans to do this throughout millennia. He and his colleagues published their findings in the journal Science in 2019. So I asked John to tell us what the fallacy is and why we do it.
The kids these days effect is the continuing belief that the youth today are lacking in specifically the ways that we are good or we excel. And it stems really from a memory bias at the end of the day, where we don't really remember the past the way we think we do. What we tend to do is we tend to take our current selves and impose it backwards in time. So if you're very well read, you tend to think, oh yeah, like everyone used to love reading back in my day. Or if you're very skilled in a certain way, you think, yes, of course, everyone was very skilled back in the day. And that sort of artificial inflation of the past creates this illusion of a decline, because you're comparing a general swath of younger people today to this sort of artificially inflated view of what things used to be like.
So it's true that the kids these days fallacy looms large over any discussion about generational change. But acknowledging this potential bias doesn't mean we should ignore how much medicine has changed or how much societal attitudes about work are changing as well. Whereas for centuries, trainees endured the physically, mentally, and emotionally exhausting climb toward independent physicianhood because they saw medicine as a calling, members of the current generation of trainees are at least as likely to consider it just another job. Austin Witt.
Treating medicine as a calling, especially as a resident, lends itself to very, very toxic work habits. I think it leads towards people doing even more work that they're not compensated for, expecting to go above and beyond at all times. You're, like, as a resident, you know, you're at the part of your career where they tell you what time and where to show up, and they don't say when exactly you can leave. And I think that's kind of where the idea of calling, especially as a trainee, can be weaponized to kind of like take this group of people who have, you know, the least power in the dynamic, but also probably the most skin in the game, because they are unestablished. They do not have a reputation. They do not have, you know, a career long CV to fall back on at this point. They're just getting started. And for many people like me that, you know, don't have much of a family safety net to fall back on, it's like we have staked so much on this that we have to commit, you know, 100% to it. And that can leave you feeling kind of stuck in a lot of ways when you're kind of up against the dynamic of you're never doing enough and you should always be doing more, and you're doing it so that financially it pays off in the end, emotionally it pays off in the end, like from a personal fulfillment, a self-actualization, that it pays off in the end. And sometimes those tunnels can get really long and dark and you can't quite see the end.
Maybe it's always been hard to see, but it seems harder because so many factors are colliding at once. The problems of our healthcare system, changing attitudes about work, and the changes we made to medical education that may have had some unintended consequences. Nino Mihatov again.
Now, almost 20 years ago, there was a dramatic shift in how we structure GME programs centered around work hour mandates. And I think that has survived multiple iterations that have led to more of a commitment or more of a structural development of shift work than it has in the development of a complete and maybe unbounded commitment to taking care of the patient for however long their presenting illness may require. And I think in addition to the structural changes, I think the attitudes of trainees are changing their mentality towards work. I think the idea of your work, particularly as an intern or a resident, may define you as one that is fading. And I think that we're also, and for really good reasons, empowering trainees to voice their concerns and their lived experiences. And the idea of put your head down and you don't complain is probably, for as I said, good reason, one that is fading. And I think there's also efforts to, I think that there's parallel efforts to try to fulfill life goals and career goals rather than having to sacrifice one for the other. And so I think that, I think not only are the trainee attitudes changing, but I do think that medicine and healthcare delivery is changing. And I think that first off, volumes are higher and hospitals are responding to those volumes in novel ways that challenge the traditional paradigm of I meet a patient at the beginning of their illness. Things like border services or increasing number of touch points with subspecialization, I think have led trainees in particular to feel like they're they're merely the cogs in a wheel.
I still believe that we've let this current generation of trainees down.
That's Joel Katz. He directed Brigham and Women's internal medicine residency program for 22 years and stepped down about a year and a half ago.
What I mean by that is there is inevitably hard work that's involved. But there's some things that we can control to make that hard work seem valuable. And we don't do that. We systematically don't do that. We rely on the house staff to do essentially our billing for us, and that's the electronic medical record. Even when I write notes, I'm a primary care doctor, I am pretty sure 99.5% of my notes are never read by anybody. They're simply a billing vehicle, and the house staff feel that even more so. Things that we could do to make that hard work worthwhile are adding flexibility to their schedule. And instead of the shift has been in the direction of efficiency and margin, and the assignments that they're asked to do aren't necessarily the ones that are most relevant to what they need as trainees. The things that I remember the most from my residency are sitting down with the patient and sitting down with the family. And while we do that, the current residents absolutely do that, they do it in much lower proportion of their time, and they spend a much higher proportion of their time in front of computers. And the ultimate effect of that, in my opinion, is it takes meaning out of their work. They don't feel that all of the altruistic things that they came to medicine with are being valued and being sort of lived out in a way that helps them make the impression that they want to in healthcare. And then in addition, I would say it takes their own sense of agency out of the equation. They feel less control, and, it's complicated why that happens, but there are ways we could design residency training to give our residents much more control over what they do. But in the effort to standardize things, it's often lost and ignored. And then finally, to me, the most important part of it is that they've lost many times, not always, but many times, they feel like they've lost their community. They don't have as much time to bond with nurses, for example, or other interprofessional people. They may or may not see their own residents on a regular basis. You know, the hospital has pegged them into a position, true of the faculty as well, but the position as interchangeable parts that are there to check off boxes that are required for billing, and things that would make their lives better are often abandoned. For example, when I was a resident, we would rotate a month long with the attendings, and we'd be on service with the attendings. And over that month, you would really get to know them well. Now, they may not have done very much supervision then, and that has its own problems, but that continuity of experience between the intern, the resident, the student, the attending, and then usually almost always a dinner at the end of the month at the attending's house, was a real connecting force and community building force. And nowadays, on most services, I think the attendings may do 2 weeks or 10-day blocks and may not even be there for the weekends. And so this sense of community, this sense of shared activity, of knowing who you're working with on a personal way, has been diminished over time.
In fact, it sometimes seems as if educators and trainees are on two different teams.
I think we sometimes create an us versus them mentality, that trainees and, let's say, program leaderships, or maybe we could extend that to attendings, sometimes create the narrative that we're on opposite sides of the problem. But I think the reality is we're all working in within the same system, that for a variety of reasons, including the realities of, let's say, mixed payers, are forced to strike a balance between the financial realities of trying to deliver healthcare and the at the expense of physician well-being or even patient care. And I think that we're more aligned in those concerns and interests than we are different. And if we're able to be on the same side of the shared problem of being motivated primarily by patient care, and also for a desire for personal and professional fulfillment, that we're able to, I think, move closer to, I think, the fundamental values of medicine that I think motivated us to embark on this profession.
So that's what this season of Not Otherwise Specified aims to do, to get the perspectives of various people, which by definition means that some of them might not see the world as you do. But that's exactly the point. There's been a cloak of silence around some of these tensions, and I don't think we can fix the real problems facing trainees until we better understand what these tensions are all about. This means taking a hard look at our training environments and remembering we're not all going to see the same thing. But addressing these challenges and fulfilling our commitment to society requires that we at least begin by sharing what it is we're seeing and why. I'm Lisa Rosenbaum. This is Not Otherwise Specified, a podcast from the New England Journal of Medicine. Follow the reporting at nejm.org. Episodes drop every Wednesday. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.